You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. We had a little mix-up last week. You're hearing this on the 19th of May. It is being recorded on the 14th of May. This week, I'm away. I'm down south for something. And, although our producers thought it was last week I was away. So there was no Orthodox Nationalist, but I did show up for the Thursday show. Now this week, there won't be any Thursday show with me, and you have an Orthodox Nationalist, which is odd, but it's not a big problem. In fact, it turns out to be a blessing, because the topic I'm dealing with, we've been talking about this book. I've been calling it my philosophical magnum opus for a very long time. It's been 11 years in the making so far. On nominalism. The rejection of nominalism, calling it the ontology of death. This has been a theme in my life for, you know, two decades. And I'm dealing with a piece of that today. I'm dealing with the Catholic Bishop of Lincoln in Britain in the 13th century, Robert Grosseteste. Very few people know who he is. People who know, you know, medieval science know who he is. He should have been an extremely significant intellect even today, and we'll get to why that's not the case. He held a very strongly Orthodox point of view on many things. There was a theory that he was even excommunicated for a while. He was at war with the Pope at the time, Innocent IV, and he fought the extension of papal power into his archdiocese. But he's known for his doctrine of light. Now, Palamas came, you know, a generation or so later, but light, as such, never really was a part of the scholastic idea in the West. I deal with scholasticism in some depth in my latest book, which is now out on medieval political philosophy, but I have to deal with it again in my book on nominalism, which I've already said, hopefully by the end of the year, I'm thinking Thanksgiving, early December at the latest, unless something unforeseen happens, and something unforeseen usually happens. What I did, which was never aired, I didn't like. Dealing with this guy is extremely difficult because he is not easy to read, and he's not easy to translate into our modern idiom. The concept here is that this physics of light could have been the dominant model of the universe in the West. You know, as the Renaissance began after his death, the development of, you know, the what eventually would be called the Newtonian universe, the Hobbesian universe, triumphed over Grosseteste's version. And these were really the two contenders. There's no scientific proof of one over the other. It's just that one had more powerful backers than the other. Part of the patristic and then later patristic idea attacking nominalism comes from light theology. those who know Palamas, it's very common, seeming the new theologian. And it starts, of course, in Genesis. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was on the face of the deep. The Spirit of God moved on the face of the waters, and God said, "Let there be light." And God saw the light, and it was good. And then God divided the light from the darkness. You hear that over and over and over again, and through repetition, it loses its force. This is an intensely powerful metaphysical doctrine. It lays out the realist point of view and explains the Trinity in depth in just a few words. You have to just know what those words mean. The idea of light is critical in all true theology. Gossetest built an entire physics, really an ontology, on light, explaining the medieval conception of the universe. Light, of course, today, in modernity, is reduced to the most crude possible definition. It's light that comes from the sun or comes from a lamp. That's not really what the word, how the word's used here. It's more like enlightenment, the light of truth. Light here is the force that holds form and matter together. It was form itself, a critical concept in metaphysics. Light refers to those elements in the cosmos that the human intellect can understand. It makes things understandable. Form, in the sense of the definition of a thing, the shape of a thing, is light in the sense that it gives reality to chaos. Chaos is unknowable. It's just a word. Light takes the chaos of matter and attaches it to form. And light must have matter. All objects are matter and form. The term light is almost always synonymous with essence, form, grace, and even energy. So God's creation of something imparts light to it, and it's this light that makes it understandable. You keep hearing the phrase, the light of God, the light of truth, and again, through repetition, it's something you roll your eyes at anymore. But essence and light, as the foundation of truth, comes from logos, the repository of the forms in the second person of the Trinity. And this is essential. Light is the principle of intelligibility. Now, for those of you who are regular listeners to this, you know enough about Plato to know what I'm talking about. It's extremely difficult to go through this without having a basic understanding of what form and matter are, what an essence is, etc. Let me very briefly explain. The forms, that's with a capital F. This is a cardinal principle of Plato's metaphysics and Orthodox metaphysics. The world appears to us, to our senses, as defective, almost in opposition to us. What we see, material world in front of us, is defective because it is fallen, but it is reflective of something more real and more perfect, the heavenly realm populated by forms, ideas that are eternal, changeless. They're paradigms for the structure and character of the world. It's the foundation of natural law. Now, the most important, again, these are not located in space and time. These are purely spiritual entities. The forms are of goodness, of beauty, equality, likeness, you know, similarity, unity, sameness, difference, change, etc. These are the things that have eternal archetypes. We talk about many beautiful things in our experience, but in order for the word to make any sense, we have to be referring to a concept of beauty beyond space and time. These are only imperfect manifestations of it. So you have many observable objects in front of us that may appear beautiful, or good, or just, or unified, or whatever. And that implies that there's one object. That is what beauty really is. And that is a source from which any beautiful thing derives. It derives its name and its corresponding characteristics. Now, this is important because our purpose in life, in the ascetic life, is to train the soul, which is a spiritual entity. It can apprehend these forms. To train the soul to shed our attachment to specific things and focus our mind on the source of things. Nominalism rejects the realm of forms and hence the spiritual realm in general. Ultimately, nominalism has to end up being atheist and materialist, although there's plenty of people who would reject that. But in order to be consistent, a nominalist who is a Christian is going to have to say that God is unknowable in the sense that there are no there's no ways to explain him or his action. You just have to take it on faith. So much of Protestantism derives from this. The concept of individualism derived from the nominalist idea. I've been talking about this for so long. Hopefully most of you know what I'm talking about. Realism is that basic school of thought in the Orthodox churches, one of them, supporting it and upholding it, that accepts the realm of the forms, separate from the material world, the archetypes of the objects that are in front of us. If there are many beautiful things, things that we call good or beautiful or whatever, then there, it implies that there is a form of beauty, beauty as such, existing in a different realm that's instantiated more or less well in these individual things. Otherwise, it's an arbitrary concept. Nonetheless, it gets in all kinds of trouble trying to explain this away. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing is the basics of medieval cosmology. Again, I have my latest book on medieval political philosophy. It doesn't really just deal with politics. It's everything surrounding it. Deals with this briefly. But the medieval view of the world is based on the Ptolemaic universe. The earth is at the center, and everything else revolved in circular motion around it. So Ptolemy wrote, essentially basing himself on Aristotle, the universe is divided into the sublunary, or the earthly regions. Our world, our solar system, which is changeable, made of matter, things come and go, passions rule, etc. And the heavenly region above it, which is immutable and unchangeable. So for the medievals, there really was a realm of forms that we didn't have access to so long as we're on earth, but that did exist somewhere. Our realm is comprised of the four elements, earth, fire, water, and air. And that includes the spheres of the seven planets, including the sun and the moon. Then the circle of fixed stars, the zodiac. And then the prima mobile, or the perfect ones, the perfect spheres that formed the outer rings of this. The outermost sphere became heaven, or the heavens, and of course the earth, because we partake in both, is the center of God's attention. The spheres exist, they rotate in perfect harmony above us. The music of the spheres, as you may have heard. But of course, since the fall, we can no longer hear that. The perfection of the heavens is unavailable to us. Now, the origin of this cosmology is something that Gossetus was very concerned with trying to demonstrate, using the concept of light or grace or essence at its core. Light in both ancient and medieval physics refers to the creation of three-dimensional space. So light, and I'm talking about now actual light, if it's uninterrupted, creates a circle because it goes, again, as far as possible in all directions. the universe is, in fact, at the speed, which matter is at its center, the Earth and the elements. The Earth is at the center because, not because it's special in some way, because it's heavier and dense. That which is less like light will gravitate to the center. That which is more spiritual points upward, because it's lighter, in a sense. All objects we could possibly have any knowledge of partake in this light. It is the stuff of the spirit, going back to creation. It's the presence of Logos, the thought of God, the second person of the Trinity, where the forms are located. Now, Gossensius also said that light is the energy, which Orthodox people are aware of, broadly considered, the engine, so to speak, that keeps the cosmos in regular motion, that brings matter from its state of potential to its state of actuality. So it's, light is more than form. It's a form in motion. Now, I know this isn't, this is very difficult to penetrate. I've been at it for a very long time. But these are the foundations for what the medieval conception of the universe was. The problem with Gossensius is that he brought it to a new level of sophistication. He is the founder of the science of optics, because of his concern with light. Light being both actual literal light and spiritual light. Gossensius says this, and I'm quoting directly from him. God is the very substance and essence of spiritual light, and no light of the spirit can shine save by participation in the uncreated light. Light streaming from a source tends to form a hierarchy of diminishing power, and the created lights in their varying degrees of participation imitate the nature of the source of light, each shining or reflecting upon the next light, which has itself received from above. The guiding principle of the whole conception is that of unity. There is a single, infinite fountain of light whose unity remains perfect even when its ray is participated in by many. The generation and extension of light downward from the spiritual sun leaves it in itself unchanged, undivided, and still transcendent to the hierarchy formed by its effusion. Although totally present to all it shines upon, it loses nothing of its interiority and its outgoing. Since all light comes from one single source, downward from the Father of lights, the work, assimilation, and transmission of light within the grades of the hierarchy, down even to the lowest, inasmuch as activity of the Lex Suprema as of the lower beings themselves. Now, the so-called great chain of being is intimated in that statement. God is the very substance and essence of spiritual light. It is the highest that, you know, it is truth as such. It is goodness as such. Now, God the Father is even beyond that. But his thought is God the Son, Logos, where these forms have their being. God the Son is not created, but he is the expression of the Father. Again, speaking from the point of view of a philosopher, not a theologian. So then he says, thus light, which is the first form created in first matter, multiplied itself by its very nature an infinite number of times on all sides, and spread itself out uniformly in every direction. In this way, it proceeded in the beginning to extend matter, which it could not leave behind, by drawing it out along with itself into a mass the size of the material universe. One problem with his account is that sometimes he goes back and forth between the light, in our sense of the term, and light in the metaphysical sense of the term. And even there, light in the sense of grace and energy in the one hand, on the other hand, light in the sense of essence and form in the other. That can be a problem. This is an extremely difficult conception to follow. Kind of like reading Hegel for the first time, which really is, I don't envy anyone who's, you know, it took me 10 years to grasp him. You're never quite finished. But it should be like this, because this is the very nature of the cosmos. What he's saying is, things move to the center of this cosmos because it's less like light. The more material, the more crude something is, the less truth it has in it, the more individual it is. Physical light is a imitation, as he says, a crude conception of essence. It's a metaphor for divine light of grace and truth. From God himself, light was diffused spherically, and it comes to an end when the outermost parts reach the limit of rarefaction. Rarefaction is the reduction of something's density. Matter can't get any less dense. Remember, form and matter can't exist separately. So where there's light, there has to be something to enlighten. And this is what he means by actualizing the potentiality of matter. And what I mean by this is that the form of something becomes fully expressed. This is what we do in the ascetic life. We are to be rational and free. Aristotle's definition of a human being. This is not too far away in following the commandments of being divinized. But being rational and free is extremely difficult. We have to get rid of the passions, the attachment to specific things. Think of it like this. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. We see in front of us, and I think I said this the last time, you see a beautiful woman. Then you consider the geometry and the chemistry of the human frame such that she looks that way. No one's ever aroused by that. You're only aroused by the specific woman in front of you. Not her very specific chemical composition, or her origin, or her participation in the forms. No one's ever aroused by an abstract woman, only a specific one. That's the difference. The universal is not something that provokes our passions. The more material something is, the more it provokes the passions in one direction or another. Either we want it or we're repulsed by it. We want to dominate it, destroy it, whatever it is. This is not the case with things as universals. To actualize matter is to be able to see its universal core, its light. You're not seeing the individual woman as this something that, at least for normal men, provokes lust. No, you're seeing the truth of God in creating all of this and her role in the cosmos. I know, that's kind of a tall order. As soon as I master it, I'll let you know. But the concept is sound. You see logos, the truth, the essence, to be found in something that you would ordinarily just want. And your passions aren't provoked anymore. It isn't to say that that shouldn't happen. Heaven knows. No way. But as far as the ascetic life is concerned, that has to be tightly controlled in a very specific arena. But his conception of the cosmos is based on light. Now you understand that this was jettisoned in favor of Thomas Hobbes and Newton later on. So God is creation of this first light, his energies. It spreads out in all directions. It reaches the end of its potential and then is reflected back inward. This is because form and matter always have to be connected. It reaches the point where matter can no longer be, it can't be actualized anymore. The example I mentioned before about human beings is as rational and free. If we're driven by passions, we're neither rational nor free. If we reach a point of dispassion, we become free. That's the difference between being only potentially human and actually a human and sanctified. Once matter reaches its full actualization, it then moves backwards. It's refracted. Light is always in motion. If it can't actualize anymore, it has to go somewhere else. It's always in motion. It's inherent in the very concept of light. It's meant to be diffused into everything. This is a creation. This is the power of God. It is meant to, as Christ says, the sun shines on the just and the unjust. So as the light returns to the center of the universe, additional rarefaction is produced. as light always carries matter with it. Light cannot exist without matter because form can exist without matter. This is how the differences between spiritual and material substances are created. Once matter can't be actualized anymore, the light then is reflected backwards. It's just reflected and refracted because there's nothing more for it to do. It has to be in motion. This is the nature of light. It's reflected to the center. Once its matter cannot be actualized anymore, it must move. It must actualize matter, almost searching for it. And light does this to infinity. It's creative. The light, as it moves from the outer to the inner, leaves matter in its wake of greater and greater levels of crudity. This is where the spheres that I mentioned came from. Each rarefied to the maximum degree, and the outer spheres anyway, perfect, because there's no potential for any additional change. The realm of the forms, the heavens. The lower regions, where we're forced to live, acquire greater density, because there's an influx of crude matter. Matter tends to, even gravity, moves downward to the center of this cosmic system. The region of great density was differentiated, of course, into the four elements. The four elements that govern our solar system. And they're subject to further condensation and rarefaction, and thus to change, because we're never totally actualized. Any object reaches its full potential, i.e. becomes actualized, when its form is completely understood. Once we have jettisoned the passions, the out-of-control passions have a place, of course, but not in and of themselves. They work for reason. Once we reach that stage, we are actualized. Now, of course, we never quite reach that stage, but that's the standard. This is sainthood. Of course, there's always going to be passions. You know, the love for God, the love for our family, that's always going to be there. But it has to be rational and within a rational system. It can't simply be lust in the sense you simply want something and you don't care who you hurt to do it. Now, it's a very strange, you know, this is so difficult for the postmodern mind to grasp because no one's used to thinking in these terms. Hobbes and Newton posited a universe of random motion without purpose. This was the death knell to rationality. This is the foundation of what now is nominalism and liberal democracy and individualism and capitalism and industrialization. It's random. The will to power. The Leviathan. It's the last man standing. So the battle in terms of physics, in terms of, you know, basic cosmic theory was between some version of this light-based theory, which is based on grace and essence and truth and hierarchy, of course, and that of the random motion of Thomas Hobbes, which developed not too long after, at the end of the Renaissance, also in Britain. The medievals always understood the cosmos as a unified entity. The upper regions are more spiritual and more perfect, needing nothing. And perfect means there's no more room for actualization. Everything's exactly how it should be. And beneath, everything is in sometimes seemingly random motion. And passion rules, and passion means irrationality. One object has to displace everything else. One person wants to dominate everything else. Nevertheless, there is an underlying unity. All light is based on form. All the bodies of the universe, no matter where they might be, they're products of this radiating light. He says, the form and perfection of all bodies is light, but in the higher bodies it is more spiritual and simple, whereas in the lower bodies it is more corporeal and multiplied. Now, through the unity based on this light, this truth, this the divine spark, motion is engendered in all bodies. So he says, but since lower bodies participate in the form of higher bodies, the lower body by participation in the same form as the higher body receives motion from the same incorporeal motive as does the higher body. There is a singularity here. But those things that have more crude matter as a part of their makeup, and of course we are body and soul, are going to be torn. It's the difference between humans and angels. We're in a very bad position because we both have a soul that is incorporeal, that is capable of comprehending this kind of thing. But we're also attached to a body. Now, our soul is such that form and matter are always together. This is why there's two judgments. We make decisions with form and matter, not just form. Our souls by themselves don't make decisions. Our souls and bodies make decisions together. That's why death is unnatural. We're not supposed to die. Death is a way to limit sin. Tearing the soul from the body is why we fear death so much. It tears this unity apart that's never supposed to be changed. But in our fallen state, the passions on the one side and reason on the other, including the spirit, are fighting one another. Plato actually makes a statement that this is how you know that there's three parts to the soul, because we constantly have to use willpower to fight the drives of the passions. The very fact that there's this entity that is fighting another entity within our same person proves that the soul is not simple. And it isn't so much that passion, these kind of lusts of various types, don't have a place, of course. You know, we make babies. It just has to be within reason. It has to be within a rational structure, both within our souls and within society. The concept here is that not just in our souls and in society, but the cosmic order is based on the same thing. Being material, you know, partaking of matter is not a bad thing, so long as that matter is kept under control. That's the problem with being a human being, especially a man. Form and matter is a problem. We are in a fallen state. Adam and Eve were not perfect. They were innocent. They couldn't even conceptualize the body and soul distinction. They were very easy targets. But there is this unity among all things, from the cell all the way to the cosmos as a whole. And that unity is light, essence, and truth. Now, in addition to that, in the mundane world, light acts as an agent of cause. It's causation. Everything acts and everything else through the radiation or the force of light. He says, a natural agent multiplies its power from itself to the recipient, whether it acts on sense or on matter. The power is sometimes called species, sometimes a likeness. It is the same thing, whatever it might be called, and the agent sends the same power into sense and into matter, or into its contrary, as heat sends the same thing into a sense of touch into a cold body. Now, these are the radiations that are responsible for causation. He says, all causes of natural effects must be expressed by means of lines, angles, and figures, for otherwise it is impossible to grasp their explanation. In other words, these causes are based on natural law. Well, natural law itself is not a material thing. The laws of matter and matter are two completely different things. The laws of matter, in fact, is an expression of light. It's a spiritual regularity. Matter and the laws that govern matter are two different things. They were created at the same time. It's always been this strange blank spot in the positivist mind that the laws of matter are never explained. Was there a time where these laws didn't pertain? Well, how can that be? How could you even talk about, you know, millions of years ago if the laws of matter didn't pertain to things? That means the laws of matter are eternal. That means they're spiritual. If they're spiritual, that means they have to have a cause. They have to have a cause that's greater than they are. And that's why you don't get invited to the faculty cocktail parties anymore. So he's referring to lines, angles, figures. He's talking about the mathematical regularity that you could find. And even later, you know, Hobbes and Newton would fully admit this, of course. It's a part of their system. Unfortunately, explaining the origin of this was another matter. And he even talks about this relative to light. These rules, foundations, and fundamentals have been given by the power of geometry. The diligent investigator of natural things can in this matter specify the causes of all natural effects, and he can do it in no other way. If all natural effects are expressible in terms of lines, angles, and figures, it's because all natural effects are reducible to the radiation of light. That means they are spiritual. That means they must have a spiritual cause. And that's the basics of the cosmology here. The cosmology that could have completely revolutionized by bringing the Western world. This mentality had to be destroyed. The Renaissance, especially Thomas Hobbes at the end of the Renaissance in Britain. And then, of course, Newton, Galileo and Descartes before that to a lesser extent, were necessary to destroy this. Remember, the Renaissance was the creation of the Medici banking family in Florence. It was the banker's culture. Nothing in the Italian Renaissance that we talk about in Renaissance textbooks occurred outside of the financing of the banking plan, especially that one. This is why alchemy was such an important idea, resurrecting the ancient pagan spells. Oh, and let me explain something, too. You get some idiot, usually like in the Antiochian jurisdiction, who'll say that the church has condemned Plato before. No. They condemned, and this is a very, very specific way, a specific type of Neoplatonism. That has nothing to do with Plato. Not a whole lot of guys who get into this, but Neoplatonism is exactly what was constructed by the Medici clan from people like Ficino and Bruno, de Mirandola. This was the use of Platonic terminology, but with the pagan mysteries that we now call the Kabbalah or Masonry. That's what was condemned. It has nothing to do with Plato as such. You would have to condemn all the church fathers. Especially Justin Martyr, I believe the greatest of them all, who called himself a Platonist, as did Gregory of Nyssa and all the rest of them, and St. Augustine and all of them. Neoplatonism is what's condemned, and that is essentially alchemy. But something tells me they're not going to tell the Masons in their congregation that that's the case. The cosmology here is based on form. Again, we spell that with a capital F, Classes of Metaphysics. The form completes, perfects, and actualizes matter. For a human being, our matter is our body. Everything that goes into it, our drives, our passions, our chemistry. Form is our soul. It's not just what animates us, but what gives us our purpose, our reason, and freedom if we struggle hard enough. We are not born with free will. Most people do not have free will. Free will is extremely difficult. It is so easy just to follow along with the crowd, to do what our passions command us. It's so much easier to do that. To use reason and the education that this requires, or the common sense that this requires, and the ascetic life that this requires, is beyond most people. I should note that I have for years, maybe 10 years ago, did a lecture on Savonarola, the nature of the Renaissance in the resurrection of paganism, which is, you know, a part of the development of usury and capitalism in the Medici banking clan. The sort of distinction between the city and the countryside, between the sea power and the land power. This is extraordinarily important. Savonarola condemned what we now today call the Renaissance because it is the foundation of usury and the oppression of the poor and the destruction of the guilds. That's what republicanism is. The murder of the king, and then the power is divided up among the, well, in symbol, the father is killed by his sons, and the father's power then is taken by the sons, and they divide it up amongst them. That's just poetry. The reality is the oligarchy doesn't want to serve anymore. They want to maximize their income and their power. They murder the king and divide up that power and wealth amongst each other. They end up killing each other, of course. That's the foundation of republicanism. That's what it was in North Italy. These guys wouldn't even have an army. They used mercenaries. They were terrified of an actual patriotic force putting them in their place. We talked about this with Poland. I mean, you know, this is the big distinction in history. Either you have monarchy in one form or another, the common good, or you have oligarchy in one form or another, the individual good. The individual good ends up simply being the will to power and the rule of a small elite based on money, and nothing more than that. That's the choice everyone has to make in their own life, but nations have to make this choice. Republicanism is the domination of matter and the rejection of form. So, in all medieval metaphysics, concepts of form, the use of something, the definition of something, perfects and actualizes the material that it's made of. In Anleit, which was Grosseteste's main work in this field, he says, it is clear that every higher body, in virtue of the light that proceeds from it, is the form and perfection of the body that comes after it. This is a hierarchy of being. So this is a concept of interaction and time. In a sense, each thing contains one other thing. Form, that is to say that the first form, light, is also the principle of activity. We use the word essence-energy distinction. This is what's referred to here. Everybody has a motion or activity that is natural to it, because it proceeds from an intrinsic principle. The intrinsic principle from which this motion proceeds must be form. Matter is generally passive. Form is active. Form is light. Form is the purpose of something. When something is used perfectly for its purpose, it then is completely actualized. But of course, in a rule of the passions, in the nominal world, people are lusting for domination and money, anger. That can't be the case. The problem there, of course, is that we're raised in a society like this. If that's what you take to be normal, if you don't see logos in the natural world, you simply see material objects clashing with no purpose, you're going to project, that's not really what's out there. You project that onto the world. This has to do with how you perceive things, not how things really are. So potency and act are connected with the idea, of course, of form and matter. Act and actualization. In the Celeste, the actualization of matter is synonymous with its extension. To actualize matter is to extend it, to actualize matter completely, leaving it no potency, no further, nothing more to do, is to extend it to the utmost of its capacity, to rarefy it, so to speak, to the highest degree. This is what light does in creation. The only potency which matter in corporeal substances contains is that of simply appearing. We talked about that in work on Scoferora and the Platonists throughout the centuries. The first body, the firmament, is perfect because it has nothing in its composition but first matter and first form. There's nothing more to actualize. Of course, we can never be fully actualized because we have the passions. We're always going to sin. We're drowning in this noumenal world. I'm sorry, this phenomenal world of cause and effect. And we're surrounded by everything we talked about this last time. And so, you know, again, sin isn't so much the act. It's the mentality that creates the act. Christ told us to be perfect. What the heck does that mean? He doesn't mean to be without, spawn. There's no way we can be sinless. But our self-understanding, the philosophical, theological, ideological makeup that we have, can be perfect. We have no excuse at that point. Of course we're going to be inconsistent. We're going to act in ways that are inconsistent with what we hold. That's almost unavoidable. That's not really the issue. The issue is the idea of sin being really a faulty understanding of the world that then produces acts based on error. That's the problem. Living a life of sin has more to do with living a life of error. That our conception of the world, the dogmas that we take to be true, are faulty. Or we're holding doctrines that are mutually exclusive. And suffering with cognitive dissonance. That's the nature of sin. Even that, to some limited extent, is unavoidable. But sin as the individual act isn't all that interesting. We're human beings. It is not our fault that we live in a fallen world, especially this savage one that we live in now. There is no excuse, however, to not have the proper ideological makeup. To understand the world for what it is. You don't have to be a philosopher. But that's what the church does. It takes the truths of what would be the prophets of Christ, Old and New Testament, really the same thing. And of course the truth, the Greek metaphysicians, and the traditions of civilizations, which are vaguely similar from a metaphysical point of view. That's something that we can, and brings that to day to day life. That's the nature of the ascetic life. That's the nature of the liturgy. You don't have to use these terms. Ritual tries to take the conceptions of metaphysics and make it normal, make it actionable every day. And that's why in the Middle Ages, everything was ritualized. Now, it's been said that the medievals were ignorant because they only believed things were made out of earth, air, fire, and water. And you have professors who will tell you that they really mean literal earth, air, fire, and water. Fire is this something that burns at the end of a match. The elements aren't elements in like a periodic table. They're primarily metaphysical ideas. In fact, everything in the Middle Ages, obviously words like light and law and truth, but also earth and fire, are metaphysical ideas. They make up our world in both quantitative and qualitative way. They're the lowest creations of light, but they still contain light within them. So what do we mean by air, for example? Air is related to creativity. It's the breath of life, our speech, our word. The winds, which are, at least in certain places, connected with the idea of creation. Air is a medium for movement, the emergence of life and truth. Light, flight, for example, scent and smell, related to the idea of air. It isn't just air that blows by you in the wind. Fire is probably one of the most important. You see in some of the Russian liturgical texts that God is fire by nature. You see this in several places. Well, they're not saying that God is in a fireplace. Although I'm sure there's many people who think that's the case. Fire is an image of energy. Now, it can be, in our world, it can be energy at the animal level, animal passion. But it can also be what drives spiritual strength. Fire, in the alchemical idea, is a critical, it's a central element, a unifying and stabilizing factor. Paracelsus talked about the parallel between fire and life. One feeds on the other to stay alive, erroneous though he was. Fire that Prometheus or Lucifer brought down to Cain and those like him. And every tradition has a story like that. you know, geometry wasn't just discovered, because you need civilization to discover it, but you need geometry to have civilization. It doesn't make sense. That's what comes under fire. That's what receiving fire from the gods. It's the mind, it's thought, for better or for worse. Water, symbolizing the universal meeting of potentialities. I mean, we read in the Genesis passage, a spirit over the waters. It's that which precedes all form, created by God before earth. And of course, connected with our baptism. Immersion signifies a return to that pre-formal state, the concept of death and annihilation on the one hand, and then we come out, rebirth and regeneration on the other. Peter drowning and Christ walking on the water. Immersion intensifies the life force. So John Chrysostom says that the waters represent death and internment, life and resurrection. When we plunge our head beneath water, as in a sepulcher, the old man becomes completely immersed and buried. When we leave the water, the new man suddenly appears. He isn't talking about the water in your pool. He's talking about water as a metaphysical idea. Years ago, when I first read Plato's Timaeus, I struggled to connect Plato's conception of the cosmos with his theory of forms. For Plato, the celestial regions were made of fire because of fire's mobility and everything that we've already, you know, what fire actually is. Fire is the realm of the forms. And that's the connection between light and form in the Timaeus. Now, Plotinus said that fire moves upward in a straight line towards its natural place. I mean, that's its own light is lightness and moving upwards. It goes to the periphery of the universe, the upper spheres. And when it arrives, it would either rest or move naturally in a circle being the sphere of perfection. Even the Stoics had a conception of fire. Aristotle, the fiery region of the upper air. Now, when the four terrestrial elements gave rise to the generation and corruption of natural substances, I mean, you know, the our lower world and the natural law is what science is supposed to study. The motion, the natural law there, is not that much different from the celestial spheres, but because of the presence of matter, it is far more crude. So, in the way that the elements go, earth and water move downward, gravitas. Fire and air, with levitas, that they moved upward away from the center. Again, even that's metaphorical. Plato held that the heavens were moved by immaterial agents, and we call them angels. And of course, he stated that, you know, in symbolic terms, to be the world soul, created according to mathematical principles, which govern the daily motion of the heavens. Heavenly bodies are, in a sense, perfect. Divine, almost in the sense of logos, almost. In the sense that their regularity is perfect and predictable. They are the manifestation of natural law. And that's why there's the origin of time. The fixed stars, for example, mark our days. The moon marks the months. And the sun marks the years. This is how we measure time. That's why the calendar is so important. It's the image of eternity, as he would say. So our souls are made up of the light as a reflection of the fixed spheres, but being embodied in our physical bodies. Embodiment in matter, and this is the nature of the fall. Now, for Plato, he made an error by thinking it was just matter as such. No, it's matter only after the fall. Matter is not evil, as the Gnostics will tell you. But matter in its fallen state certainly is. It's matter out of control. That's the problem. When our souls embodied in matter, it takes the previously perfect motions of the world soul and makes it confused. The fourfold disturbances of these of our bodily demands and processes, not to mention the impact of external things on us, even in sense experience, creates this war between mind and body. a lower matter is a principle of chaos. And this is what impairs the soul's functioning. And this is what we're born into. The whole point of philosophy is that education can bring the regularity, the natural law found in the soul, to be reestablished and our proper cognitive functioning be restored. Grace is just another word for light. God's energy, his presence in all things. God's essence is not something we could even talk about. Logos, however, the second person of the Trinity, does contain the essences of all things. Even the way our bodies are designed is meant to support the proper functioning of the soul. So he talks about, the design of the eyes, the mechanics of vision, how body and soul are one thing. We only see them from different points of view because we are fallen. And Plato wouldn't talk about fallenness, but we certainly do. Now, because of all this, Grosseteste holds that an object's existence is its dependence on God. It's not that a thing doesn't depend on God for its existence. Its dependence on God is its existence. So he says, something no more partakes of actual existence except insofar as it adheres to the first being that is all at once. That is first form. That is God's energy in the purest possible form. Now, what does this have to do with nominalism? Grosseteste says this. I say that it's possible to have some knowledge without the help of the senses. For in the divine mind, all knowledge exists from eternity. Not only is there a certain knowledge of universals, but also singulars. Similarly, intelligence receiving irradiation from the primary light sees all knowable things, both universal and singular, in the primary light itself. Moreover, the divine mind, in the reflection of its intelligence upon itself, knows the very things which come after itself, because it's their cause. Therefore, those who are without any senses have true knowledge. The highest part of the human soul, which is called the intelligence, and which is not the act of any body and does not need for its proper operation a corporeal instrument, this intelligence, if it were not obscured and weighed down by the mass of the body, would itself have complete knowledge from the irradiation received from the superior light without the help of senses, just as it will have when the soul is drawn forth from the body, and as perhaps those people who have been free from the love and the imaginings of corporeal things. Now that statement we just said, we are released from the pull of material things upon the moment of our death. And he says, I'm pretty sure he's tongue-in-cheek here, that relief will come from those people who are free from the love and the imaginings of corporeal things, meaning those who are not attached to the things of this world. Because we're weighed down with fallen nature, and our logic can be faulty too. Reason is not logic. It's two different things. Because we're weighed down with the world, really not so much body or matter, but the nature of the fallen world itself, we're weighed down by this, and therefore we need the senses to look at individual things, find their similarities, and then maybe get a glimpse of the essential form that makes it up. See, nominalism takes human sin and makes the normal constitution of the psyche. Universals are the only form of knowledge that could possibly be, but our sin makes it very difficult to rise above particular objects. Then he says, because the purity of the eye of the soul is obscured and weighed down by the corrupt body, all the powers of this rational soul born in man are laid hold of by the mass of the body and cannot act, and so are in a way or asleep. Accordingly, in the process of time, the senses act through many interactions of sense with sensible things. The reasoning is awakened and mixed with these very sensible things and is borne along in the senses to the sensible things as in a ship. But the functioning of reasons begin to divide and separately consider what in sense were confused. The reasonings does not know this to be actually universal, except therefore has made this abstraction from many singular things and has reached one and the same universal by its judgment taken from many singulars. The experimental universal is acquired by us, whose mind's eye is not purely spiritual, only through the help of the senses. for when the senses several times observe two singular occurrences, one of which is the cause of the other, or is related to it in some other way, and they do not see the connection between them. Now, this is some of the foundation of sort of an empirical realism. Being asleep is to hold that only specific things exist, to live in an animal mode of existence. Perceptions are remembered. You know, we see similar things, different forms of love, for example. And the operant agent intellect then works on this and slowly uncovers the universal love with a capital L. That's the foundation of it all. The mind then is awoken because it's now alerted to the truly spiritual world. The light. The light that's found in the upper regions. So he takes the experimental method, which he actually helped create, as the way by which nominalism is defeated. This knowledge is a proof of light. Objects of mathematics are proof of the forms, as St. Augustine also said. The logos of the world seen from the point of view of ontology. Well, I appreciate you guys if you've hung on this long, but I think you're getting an outline of what could have been the physics of light. Instead, it was replaced by Hobbes and Newton. Now, light theology is pretty rare in the West. In the East, with Palamas and Gregory the New Theologian, it's everywhere. The essence-energy distinction is at the core of it. That means Grosseteste actually had a conception of the Orthodox point of view in this matter. He was a translator of Greek. He knew the Greek world very well. The scientific world at the cusp of revolution during his time. The physics of light was a main contender and at war with what eventually became the Newtonian universe. It was removed from speculation about the physical world as Thomas Hobbes' view took over. It's true there's some centuries, a period of time that separates them, but the revolution of the Renaissance and what came after it destroyed the reputation of Robert, the Bishop of Lincoln. The Western world would be unrecognizable had this man, rather than Hobbes, become the dominant paradigm for physics. The big difference, of course, that Thomas Hobbes posited a spiritual world that could be made into anything Leviathan wants. Leviathan is the only source of right. Leviathan is the initiated elite. The Royal Society and the Lunar Society made sure that that ideology buried that of the metaphysics of light, which threatened it. Promoting Hobbes and Newton over Grosseteste is a primary goal of the group, and Britain produced these two absolutely dominant minds. He revolutionized physics with this idea. He posited a meaningful world arranged in hierarchy of intelligibility. Plato and Aristotle were put on a whole new footing and could have joined Eastern Orthodoxy and Western metaphysics. Therefore, he's been reduced. Grosseteste has been reduced to a footnote in scientific history. One of the few Westerners to fully understand the essence-energy distinction and using the term light to express it. Had his conception of the physical universe been accepted, rather than Hobbes and Newton and Descartes, our world would be absolutely unrecognizable. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.